And I think more in the sense that it'll be filling in some of the details that he went over relatively quickly, because I think even numerically we get things that are very similar to what he showed. First part I'll go over a little bit quickly as well, in just trying to fill in some gaps of the discussions that we had in the last day or so. So first part will be a little bit standard, and then I'll get spend probably the last half on the variation of the couplings. This one we know. This is just here just to point out, I don't know if it showed up, but you know, the 5-year data changes the number always a little bit, the fraction of a sigma, which is nice. The error bar did come down somewhat, and so the value of eta now is a little bit smaller. And that's what the standard plot that's using the things that did with Rich and Brian for the BVN part. And there you see the WMAP strip at 1 sigma there. It's pretty narrow. So it's you get a pretty well-defined value for what the BVN predictions are going to be. I show this, the deuterium, just because of the discussion we had yesterday. Nobody else could see it except for Karsten, who is right behind me. And let's see, there's he wants me to use the hockey stick. So the new point is that one that was from a couple of months ago. And so what Karsten was, referring to was the fact that, if you take that point out, it doesn't look that great. You know, these three are sort of in a line, but these two are below, these three are above. There doesn't seem to be a real well-defined mean. And that is, I think, a valid concern, that the dispersion here, unlike lithium, is much larger than the individual error bars in the data.
Oh, this is some measure of metallicity in
the system.
That's local interstellar medium. Okay, so that's different from these other points. But yeah, don't worry about that point. And that error bar is probably way too small.
So you expect it to be depleted there already?
Yeah, you expect it to be depleted. That's today. I don't have the same figure with the curve on it. The curve would go pretty much straight like this and then dive down pretty much at the end. Standard chemical evolution model would do something like that. Okay, the new one is nice. It comes in right with the other ones. Makes the fit, the average a little bit better, drives the dispersion down a little bit. And so now, it's up to you whether you want to take the mean and scale that, the uncertainty in the mean with chi-squares, which is a standard way of doing it, or you want to take some sort of range of the data. There's the BVN prediction and the observational average now, and this is 1 sigma. This is the average of 7 of the points. There are 2 that these people put very little weight on, just because they feel that the observations themselves are bad, even though the error bars don't show it. I'm not 100%. It's 1 of these 2 and 1 of these 2. I don't remember which ones, but this is an average of 7 of the 9 points that are there. The one at the top is just an upper limit, so you shouldn't read anything from that. And then this is just the these blue bands are from the data. The darker one is the what you would get from actually taking the mean, scaling it, and then the wider one is just taking the full range from the of the data with no statistics.
Determined
from BVN. No, this is not the eta determined. This is from deuterium.
So eta determined from the concordance of BVN prediction with deuterium observation.
This band. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it's using the deuterium measurement between here and here is just coming from the previous slide. Either you're taking the mean or you're just taking, the overall band of data. Okay, that's. Understood. Everybody knows that the deuterium and WMAP come out.
Is your lithium 7 line a little wider than it should be with a new measurement of helium 3 to 4?
I don't know.
Rich, hasn't been
Okay, so actually, okay. The green one is also a factor of the narrow, so it's very nice.
There's enough new data to bring down the error bar in looking at 7Y factor 2.
To bring the lithium abundance down?
No, 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 no.
The error.
So
the width in the green line.
The green one is narrow as well.
Yeah, but careful. The green line, you'll see that lithium. This is just a deuterium plot. This is not. The others are there.
I'm just commenting on the width of the green line. That's all.
Oops.
It'll stay one at the bottom.
So let me just say a few things about helium 4. This is from one of Isidoff and Fon's paper. I think it's their 90. This is a more recent paper because this has both. This paper is a Isidoff and Fon paper. That's the 98 paper. This is probably Isidoff and Fon 2004. They have lots of data, and the intercept that they get, they fit this with a linear regression as a function of the oxygen abundance. And they get a very small uncertainty in that intercept. That's all that this error means is that the intercept that they determine is determined very accurately with that data, and doesn't include any of the systematics. Each of the points, the method that they put forth is a good method for determining the helium abundance in a given point. Basically, what they do is they determine, they start with the hydrogen and determine the properties for the hydrogen lines. They determine the from the intensity and equivalent width of both hydrogen and helium. But they start with hydrogen. They get the reddening to adjust the baseline over different wavelengths when you go over to helium, and take into account the hydrogen underlying absorption. Then they typically use 5 lines, but they could have used 6 lines as they had it in their data. 6 helium emission lines, and that they're going to use to determine the physical parameters of the system. There's the electron density, the optical depth of the H2 region. They fix the temperature with the oxygen abundance, but you can get then the underlying helium absorption. They assume that that's negligible in their data. And from that, you get the helium-4 abundance as well. So you can use the lines to get all the properties of the system. Trouble is that what we found is that there are lots of degeneracies that you get when you do Monte Carlo analysis. And so here's an example of that. This is based on data from Pimbert et al. The top has a fixed temperature. So the top just uses the temperature that the Pimberts used. And what these plots are showing, this is now as a function of the electron density, this is the helium abundance, or here it's a function of the underlying absorption. The central cross is the value that Pimbert et al. Got. And one of these two points, I don't remember which right now, I can't see the difference between them here. Doesn't matter, they're close enough. One of the points is what you would get from just directly taking the data and using this self-consistent approach to derive the helium abundance. The little points that you can see that scatter all over here is what you get from the Monte Carlo. So what you're doing is you're taking the data, the raw data, within the errors, letting them vary within the errors, and using the same technique to get the helium abundance. So in principle, any one of these points is as good as any other point because it's all within the error of the actual measurement. And so the determined error in the helium abundance, then it must be this one that's from the Monte Carlo, gets to be larger. And that gets to be significantly larger when you allow the temperature to vary as well, and a number of things happen. You see now that when you allow the temperature to vary, that is, you don't fix it to the oxygen abundance. You fix it to be whatever the helium lines give it to you to be. You get considerably different results. This is the direct approach, that is, taking the raw data. And the thing to look at here is the size of the error bar in the individual point. That would be what, for example, what Isatov and Tuan would be quoting for the error bar in an individual point. This is what you get from the Monte Carlo. So the error in an individual point can be 3 or 4 times larger. Okay. And so you see, again, the very big spread in the data. And again, in terms of the chi-squared, each of those points is basically as good as any other point. So there's no real way to say that the uncertainty in a given measurement
is tiny because the method itself doesn't permit that. So when
Evan and I
looked at this a few years ago, first of all, out of all their 100 points, we found that even based on their own criteria of what is, should be considered a good point, that is that the emission lines are strong enough that it doesn't have, it's not sitting at a redshift where the data could be masked with other lines, that the oxygen abundance was sufficiently low. Out of their 100 points or so, there are only 7 of them that satisfied their own criteria. And those 7 we reanalyzed, and you can tell which ones are ours and which ones are theirs. This is the most blatant example. That's one of their points that they use in their fit, and this is the uncertainty we get from their data. It's just their data, just reanalyzed. And this is an exaggerated point, but you see all of the points. When you use the Monte Carlo, you get much larger values. If you then go and do the regression, you get a significantly larger error. And so that's what that's based on. With a student we're looking at, with Eric Aver, trying to see if we can't break the degeneracy. Instead of doing hydrogen first and then helium, we're trying to do everything at the same time, using 9 lines now, 3 hydrogen lines, 6 helium lines, and trying to fit all of the parameters at once. In principle, 3 things could have happened. Either you could have established new degeneracies and make the uncertainties even bigger. We could have broken the degeneracy, which would have made the uncertainty a lot smaller. Unfortunately, it looks like previous degeneracy remains, and although no new ones have been generated. So it looks like the uncertainty, even doing it this way, which is probably the better way of doing it for a lot of reasons, is not going to change that answer very much. Okay. Yeah.
The analysis does probably not take into account, like additionally, like I'm sorry, temperature fluctuations and ionization faction corrections.
This does not. That would come on top. Those are generally small in comparison, but you're right, they don't. And so, if anything, they would just add to the uncertainty a little bit more. So anyway, that's if you're wondering, you know, why we're getting the big uncertainty, that's what it's coming from. The mean of the 7 points is actually a little bit better, 0.003. So, and probably with 3 points, that's good enough. So you can, but then the value is higher. So you can choose how you want to do it. In any case, it's in pretty good shape with respect to the BBN predicted value. And okay, that's what you get for that. All right, lithium. So I don't want to spend too much time on the lithium observations. That's been talked about. That's
the reason why the AI might become so smaller. AI becomes smaller.
The air becomes
bigger. You are bringing
it's not the same quantity. That's you mean this one?
Yeah.
That's just a mean. So if you're trying, this is the regression of these 7 points. And with 7 points, you don't determine the intercept very well, because you don't know how you're going to draw the line, right? You could actually draw the line in almost a non-physical way so that it's actually increasing. And then so the 7 points don't allow you to get a good regression for 2 parameters. If instead you just take the mean of the data,
No.
Oh, that's not what this number is. These both are the old analysis. Right?
Okay.
We don't have a number for the new analysis. Okay, so this is the standard lithium problem, where here's what the lithium data looks like. There's the BBN prediction. Okay, if you want to make the error bar a little bit smaller, it's fine. But it's off by a factor of 3 or so, and that's what everybody's been talking about. I won't go through this in much, but because this has, I think, been covered, that
depletion is one possibility. We don't like that because of the dispersion. The nuclear rates we discussed a little bit yesterday. Show up there. Stellar parameters, I don't know how much that was discussed. I don't know if one of you two covered. So this was still somewhere in deep in my heart, this is still my preferred solution. But that if you notice that the lithium abundance is dependent on the input parameters that go into the determination of the lithium abundance, which includes the surface temperature, the surface gravity, the metallicity. And it's actually fairly sensitive to the surface temperature. This is in log units. Probably should have the little brackets here, but it's 0.08 in a log for every 100 degrees that you change the surface temperature. And there was some work done a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, by Melendez and Ramirez. They took 41 stars, and they found, with respect to the data I just showed from Ryan et al., they found systematic temperatures higher by about 100 to 300 degrees, and that brought up the lithium abundance considerably. That's what their data relative to Ryan et al. Looked like. So this is their difference in their effective temperature, the surface temperature, as a function of metallicity. And you see it actually even goes up to 400, 500 degrees at the very low metallicities, which are the ones you care about. And so that was very exciting. I think that was, and it gets you down to something like this, where this is the discrepancy between lithium. So there's still a little bit of a problem. They didn't quite resolve it, and the hope was, well, maybe the surface temperatures were just a little bit higher still than what they found. There's a lot of systematic uncertainty in that. So, Sean Wright?
Ask by other people?
What?
They're playing.
Well, that's exactly what this slide is. So, Ryan and his students, Hosford, we decided to go and make a dedicated measurement of what that surface temperature would be. Just use a different, now there are a lot of different methods of getting this, the surface temperature. And this is the comparison with Melendez and Ramirez and those observations that they just did.
And what you see is that the Melendez and Ramirez are higher. What they find is actually similar to the old Ryan et al., which I think what this is the old Ryan et al. That I showed before. So their new temperatures are pretty consistent with the old ones.
Which is making the discrepancy about a factor of 4 or 5.
No, 3 or 4. That just brings it back to where it was.
Oh,
okay. So this is that data
for the lithium using their new temperatures. And there's a little bit difference depending on which of the data, whether you use main sequence stars or subgiant branch stars. But basically, we're back down to the old numbers again. So.
I don't remember the number. I mean, what do you see?
So it's work in progress.
It's been submitted. It's not.
Is it still in archive?
No, the astronomers don't like to do that, even despite my protest, but they don't like to do that.
What is about the secrecy? I don't know.
So particle decays, that was the dominant thing of this meeting by far, is to talk about dominant. And then, you know, there are three of us here, and we talked about it beforehand. We wanted to make sure that none of us, that we didn't all talk about the same, give the same talk. So what happened is none of us gave the talk. So I'm only going to show 2 slides from this work. So the question here that we pose is whether or not you can use, you know, supersymmetric models that are of the type that, you know, are interesting and the type that are very well studied. This is a CMSSM model, which has been discussed, the constrained model, so how plot of the Gugino mass and the scalar masses here. This is the panel on the left is the case where there are no bound states included. That is, if you were doing it before Maxime's paper, and the shaded region is everything that's pretty much okay. Lithium isn't particularly okay, but it's no worse than it would have been otherwise. So this,
rather than peaks is fully satisfied.
These curves here are just the abundance curves. And so we're just saying we're satisfying the abundance constraints. We're not worrying about lithium on the left panel because you know, we're not making it any worse, but we're not making it better. Okay, that's the left panel, so everything here is allowed. You have to also notice this plot goes out to 5 TeV, and so you know, normal plots would have always looked up just in this region, and a lot of that region would have been allowed. This is Gravitino dark matter. Gravitino dark matter is everywhere in this whole region. It's just in this little wedge where you don't have Gravitino dark matter. the gravitational mass is just set by fiat to be 0.2 times M0 in this particular
plot. Well, like Parsons say, you find the suppression of lithium 7 already, right, in the left.
You're in the left plot? Depends where you're sitting, right?
The constraints rule out lithium.
It depends. If you're here, I don't remember the numbers, but here's suppression here. This curve, this is a lithium curve, and this is a lithium curve. So this one, I don't remember. This might be 2 times 10 to the minus 10 here. So if you're sitting here, then, yeah, you would get a suppression.
If you
remind me if I'm wrong.
Let me, I want to add one thing to this. So you get a suppression 57, it's clear.
Yeah.
But if you would relax your Leterme constraint from 4 to 4.3 or something like this,
then this would move up a little bit.
No, you would also have red area. So like in other words, you know, like on your left.
I see. Because I'm going to creep into here.
Yeah.
Well, I have to creep up to here or something. Right. This is the lithium 6 of 0.01. So I want to be above. In principle, I would want to be above this curve. So yeah, you're right. If I relax this, and I presume
you're quite close to opening up.
Yeah, you want the dotted green.
I want the dotted green.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So you know, I have to. I don't remember what the number is, but yeah, you're right. If I increase the deuterium abundance significantly, but 4 is pretty high already.
4 is high. But in other words, our calculations are actually consistent with each other.
Okay.
Because I have the same result. Yeah. You know? But at 4, like the solutions come in if you don't have bound state effects.
Right. So yeah, so this is without bound state, and then here's what happens with bound state. And I think first the most dramatic thing is this whole region at relatively low gauge genome masses just goes away. And that's because those have the higher lifetimes and you get the tons of lithium 6 there. And then this is one example where we were able to find this spot where you get good lithium 7 abundances, and everything else is pretty reasonable as well. Of both lithium 7 and lithium 6. So that shaded region, you get both of them.
Do you have a particular motivation for choosing the Carmichael mass to be 0.2 times M0?
So this appears. I think in some of the other examples that you didn't get this nice solution. So for this particular choice, you got it. I mean, you can do all sorts of things. But no, there's no other specific reasonable motivation for it. So this, I also talked very briefly yesterday afternoon about the sugar model. So this is a CMSSM plot with a fixed gravitational mass, 10 beta 10. This is an M-sugar plot, and now you notice, first of all, there's no tangent beta fixed here. Tangent beta is actually solved at every point on here because you have the relationship between the V0 and A0 is now fixed. A0 here is the Polonyi value. This is in units of M0. So this is 3 minus root 3 times M0. And this is gravitational mass equaling to M0. And you see what the bound states do is they now push you into this corner. The only place you can live is way out in that corner, which is.
What are the typical tangents beta values that you have?
It's not on here. I have a different plot which I didn't put for this talk. But they're about 15 to 20. Then there's no high tangent beta. There's
not such a big variation.
It goes from maybe 5 to 25 across here. But there's, you know, you don't get 40 or 50. There's also no focus point regions. You can study that. And that it all has to do with how you're solving mu and the relationship between V and A. Okay. So that's all I wanted to say about that. And so the last part of the talk is on the fundamental constants. This we can go fast. Victor also mentioned there's lots of models. It's easy to make models in which the fundamental constants vary. You can, depending on a couple of the curvature, you couple of the F squared. It's your choice, of course, Jordan Brzezinski theory. You won't get alpha varying, but you get everything else varying.
The ratio of the masses. It's the Newton constant will be varying relative to the masses, right?
This is with the conformal rescaling. So here, Newton's constant is fixed, and then everything else is varying.
No, but the ratio of, say, lambda QCD to the mass of work would more.
Would vary. Yeah.
Okay, I'll
get to that.
The same issue of the UV compression.
Here's the mass scale that fixes the Planck scale. Planck scale is fixed here. Everything else varies relative to the Planck scale.
Let's say our mean is no brandy.
Yeah. No, absolutely. But this is just a motivation. It doesn't get used for anything. And okay, I don't really need this. This is the same as Victor. I'm only going to talk about BBN. I'm not going to talk about any of the other things down here. And I think this also we all know about the concordance. Usually it's done with, you know, this is probably deuterium there, but usually it's done with helium and trying to get concordance. You can get limits on all sorts of things. Particle types, particle interactions, masses.
And the thing that we're interested here is just the variation of the constants. And again, just to remind you, this is all elementary for, I think, for everybody here. But everything comes about because you get this the freeze-out condition where you're looking at when the weak interactions relative to the expansion rate freezes out. And what had been done for you know very well that that's what determines the neutron to proton ratio, and from that you get the helium abundance. And so if you do something that changes the freeze out temperature, you vary GF or you vary the number of particle degrees of freedom, whatever it is that's in that equation that might be varying, you'll vary TF if TF is higher, N over P is higher, and Y is higher, and that's usually what got used to say. Set limits on, say, the number of neutrino flavors. Okay. For helium, for the variation in alpha, it goes back, it's been done for years now, the setting limits on delta Y over Y. And it's usually done by looking at the change in the neutron to proton mass difference. You can expand that out. So you can look at where does delta Y over Y come from. It would come from the change in the neutron to proton ratio. Neutron to proton ratio is then determined by the changes in freeze out or the change in the nucleon mass difference. And there's where it's more sensitive. You have in the nucleon mass difference, you have the fine structure constant appearing directly.
Because
their errors are about
the embarrassing thing. You read about it, and the reference goes back to some 1860s, right? And you think
might be different. So I mean, these are old numbers, but okay. And so you see, if you change alpha, you'll change this number, and you'll change the helium abundance. And you can get typical helium abundance. We take about 5% uncertainty in the helium abundance. You can translate that to essentially a 5% uncertainty in the variation of alpha. If you now start doing all of these coupled variations, which Victor was talking about, you can get a couple of extra orders of magnitude.
Because you divide on a large log, right?
Yeah, lambda QCD.
That's
right. I'll get to that in a second. But that is actually, I think, Bruce Campbell and I have looked at that first because we did this 15 years ago or so, mainly because we were talking about dilaton string theories, the effect of the dilaton, and how all that couples. And then,
which is also ill-defined.
No, it's ill-defined, but in the simplest type of models, sure. Once you get out of that, so the approach is that that I'm going to take now for the rest of the time is that consider variation. Everything is allowed to vary. I'm not restricting myself. So the Yukawa couplings and the fine structure constant will allow to vary in a particular dilaton type string model. Then there will be a relationship between those variations, so usually a factor of two, for how the dilaton, which is then supposedly causing these variations, it relates them. So. And then we'll include the dependence of varying alpha and varying the Higgs expectation value, which is the variation in lambda is coming from the variation in alpha, the variation in B is coming from the variation in H. And then we consider the effect on the neutron-proton mass difference, neutron lifetime, and the binding energy of deuterium. And so here we just write everything out and expand everything into these quantities. So now delta Q over Q, so the nucleon mass difference will have a piece coming from delta F over alpha, delta lambda over lambda, a piece, I guess that should be H, from the change in the Yukawas and a change in V, if that's possible. So all of those things might contribute. Same thing for the neutron lifetime. Just expand that out. We'll get reduced down to here. All the individual contributions are there. In the end, we'll take all the Yukawas to be varying identically. The binding energy of deuterium, we based on Victor's work, which actually, to be honest, we got a hell of a lot of trouble for, but eventually that was okay. The referee really didn't like this, even though we did. I think this is from Victor's paper that is using a fairly reasonable approach for trying to estimate how the deuterium binding energy varies with the important contributions coming from sigma, omega, nucleon mass terms. Then if you put in the variation of lambda on top of that by dimensional grounds, you know what that coefficient is just based on that expression. Now, just before anybody worries, you'll see there's a lot of uncertainty in all these coefficients. Some of them are not quite so uncertain, but some of them are very uncertain. But if you take this, then you would expect a dependence on lambda to be something like that. And you'll see also none of this matters. And there is a dependence on the quark masses. This is a slide I use for other talks. So I don't know if you either say I'm lazy or I'm just trying to give you additional information. And this came up in terms of why the strange quark is so important. We actually know this, and it comes into all the dark matter work that we do in terms of looking at what are the spin-independent neutralino proton cross-sections for dark matter detection. Okay. That cross-section actually will depend exactly on the same quantity that Victor is interested in, and that's the quark mass contribution to the nucleon mass. Now, nucleon mass, of course, then the sigma mass and the omega mass as well. Here I'm going through it for the proton mass, because that's what I knew from other things. And that quantity, it's going to be determined by is the pi nucleon sigma term, which is defined here. Those are these matrix elements specifically for the U and B quark. And typically, people have taken a range for this sigma term to be between 45 and 64. When we looked at and tried to match with Victor's result, we needed a sigma 51, so it's perfectly consistent with this. Yes. Yeah. Well, that's here. And for that cross. So where is the strangeness contribution? There's another quantity here, which is essentially the shift in the nucleon mass due to the non-zero quark masses, about 36 MeV. And you can also use some sum rules. And that will give you effectively what the shift in the nucleon mass is as in terms of the shift in the strange quark mass. And that's about 0.19. That I think uses, that's I think the number you had, and that's the number that you get from sigma of about 51. As you change sigma, that coefficient will change. It actually changes substantially. Yes, absolutely.
With SYS over the nucleon.
Right. Absolutely. It could be between about 0 and 40% probably.
Like this, in the other channel, the axial vector channel, this S bar gamma nu gamma 5, you know, there was a lot of thoughts in the early 90s how the strangeness contribution in this channel is not zero. Now suddenly you don't hear anything because it's now back again consistently.
There is something interesting that happens though. But this coefficient is very uncertain. I don't remember what the variations, even between 45 and 64, and even that's not, you could go between 36 and 80 probably, and this number would change quite a bit. There's a huge uncertainty in that number. Much smaller uncertainty in this number, you get all these matrix elements this way, you get between about 4% and 6%. That's a little higher than the number that Victor had, but it doesn't matter. And then you can get the variation in the proton mass, just plugging everything in now.
But this is also a function of time as we speak, because, you know, the pi nuclear and the sigma term is being registered and its value fluctuates, right? So I remember time when it was 45 MeV, when it was 70 MeV, and could be, you know, go either way.
But that all goes into this number. That all goes into that number.
At least it's something that you know where it's coming from. At least you can track it to something, right? It's everything, and even that becomes unimportant because we eventually have other numbers that come in that we have no way of tracking, okay? So we end up with this. I think this is the number from Victor, and that's the thing that we found that's amusing, I think. This now sums in all the contributions, not from the nucleon mass, but from omega and sigma. This number, the minus 17, actually seems to be very independent of the capital sigma. That is, from 45 to 64, this thing changed from minus 16 to minus 19 or something like that. So even though the strangeness contribution to the nucleon mass changes a lot, this number, because of all the cancellations and summing up, this number happened not to change very much at all. So this number is not very dependent on that particular quantity.
Binding energy is this attractive force due to the pion exchange and the repulsive core, which you do with the mesons, right? But there could be some, you know, other models.
Yeah, that's here.
Non-mesonic repulsive.
Here you go. Right, so Bean and Savage in particular, they really didn't like that method of getting the binding energy. And there are other ways where you can track it directly to the pion mass. That's fine. You get a different expression. But, you know, it's different in the sense that, you know, the coefficient here and here is going to be different from the one that you get up there. In the end, I don't care about that either. But it'll be different. So the coupled variations, so this Victor mentioned as well, when alpha varies, you're going to get a variation in lambda. Actually, that variation in lambda will not only carry the variation in alpha, but also carry variations in the Higgs expectation value and in the Yukawa's as well. So if you include all of that, you would get an expression. You can relate now delta lambda over lambda to remove that from all the previous equations. And then you get the first constant that Victor mentioned. In the standard gut SU5 type model, that number would be about 30. But then, you know, it's going to be very model dependent, and it could be very different from 30. So that's why a lot of these other issues don't matter so much, because now you've got an overriding constant here, which is very unknown. Okay. So just keep that in mind. So the new sensitivities now with the lambda removed now have delta alpha over alpha and delta V over V and delta H over H. Okay. You get numbers like that. The big thing that's uncertain
is the R. Now, what about the Higgs expectation value? Let's get out of that. So now again, in models with radiative electroweak symmetry breaking, the Higgs VEV will get determined by dimensional transmutation and becomes very sensitive to the top quark Yukawa coupling. So very small changes in HT will generate large changes in delta V over V. Now, how large are those changes? Well, okay, that's going to give us another number that's very uncertain. And by the way, this is the number that we're going to use for if the end want to relate the Yukawa variations to the gauge coupling unifications, and that's again coming just from these very simple dilaton models.
Here's a supersymmetric model. How are we going to get something to do about delta v over v related to delta h over h? This is actually very reminiscent of the whole fine tuning problem in Suzy theories. What is that? That's essentially the fine-tuning parameters that people talk about in CMSSM or any other variant of the minimal supersymmetric standard models. To define a fine-tuning parameter, which is essentially asking you how much does the weak scale change, either the Z boson mass or W boson mass change, when you vary some of the standard model parameters, input parameters. And so that's a well-defined quantity. You can now plot that quantity on the standard plane. So here's one of those standard planes, again, showing what these deltas are. And they range from, for tan beta 10, they're in the range of a few hundred. for a tangent beta of 50 that can be somewhat larger. And the dominant contribution to this, depending again on where you are in the plane, is often the top fork Yukawa coupling. And so that total delta might range from 100 to 400, maybe going up to 1,000. The contribution coming from delta T is about 80 to 250, might go up to about 500. So that ratio, which is very uncertain, this we're going to call that another parameter. Probably a good number for that other parameter is something on
the order of 100 or 200, but we don't know what it is because it's extremely model dependent. But it allows us to get rid of delta V over V, and now we get the three quantities coming in again. And so now we have everything in terms of variations in alpha and variations in the Yukawa, and in terms of these uncertain parameters S and R. And if you want to use the pion thing, you would get something analogous. Again, they have S and R in it as well, so it doesn't matter. And then if you would do the final step is to now link these things, and now you get everything in terms of variations in L, okay? In terms of the S and R that are very, just in keeping in mind that those are the uncertain quantities. Everything else is buried inside them, okay? So then you get the results. And this is comparing, this has no variation in alpha per se, but has only a variation in the Yukawa coupling. The solid curves have no variation in the coupling, so that's standard model, and the dashed curves have variations in Yukawas. All the variations in the Yukawas are taken to be equal at 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5, and the only thing to notice here are these two, which is the drop in the beryllium abundance, which is significant. Okay.
The main thing is that just you shifted the deuterium recombination on the later.
That's the next slide. You're always one slide ahead. I think it's the next slide. There it is. So if you want to see where that effect comes from, this is breaking it down to the different contributions: neutron, proton, mass difference, deuterium binding energy. Can't read this on myself. Oh, ME, the variation in electron mass, variation in the neutron lifetime. So each of these is now shown to be separate, as Victor said in his talk. The dominant effect is coming from the deuterium binding energy. So delta X over X here is any one of these variations. And so delta for the blue curve here, that delta X over X is delta BD over BD, then using everything else that we've put in. For this particular choice. And so you see here, and for lithium abundance, for a few percent or so in delta BD over BD, you get this very big drop in the lithium abundance.
And at the same time, more deuterium.
A little bit more deuterium. That's right. So that'll show up in the next box. I'm almost actually done, because now the rest is just showing what the results are, and then the change in the helium abundance as well. Okay. So here's an example. Again, with delta alpha over alpha equal to zero, showing three different choices of this S. Remember, S is the relative effect between the Higgs expectation value and Yukawa's. If you forget about lithium and just want to set a limit on the variation of these quantities, you could do that. So for a particular choice of S of 160, you would get a limit on the variation in the Yukawas on the order of 10 to the minus 5 or so. And that's making sure you don't screw up. In this case, probably deuterium the most is what's getting screwed up. So it's just making sure that the deuterium abundance is in good agreement. And then you see that if you get a shift in the Yukawa couplings, which is on the order of a few times 10 to the minus 5, a little bit larger than that, then, or on the same order of that, actually, you see, then you could get the lithium abundance dropping appreciably. So depending on which data you want to match, you have to go out either further or less far in delta H over H. But that's the order of magnitude change that you need in the Yukawas to get lithium down. Helium is okay, and deuterium you have to be a little bit careful about. And so here's another example. This has S to be fixed now at 240, showing three different values of R. The 36th is the SU5 value, and it's showing the value of 0 and 60 as well. And this also has that
delta alpha over alpha is twice the variation in Nucalis. Picture looks more or less the same. Again, you get the drop of lithium for a Nucalis, a variation of Nucalis by a few times 10 to the minus 5. If you neglect lithium, because you're not making it better, but you're making sure that you don't, well, you would actually make it better, but you're making sure at least that you don't mess up the deuterium or helium, you get, again, limits on the order of a couple times 10 to the minus 5 for those variations. And this is, I think, the last thing. For fixed variations in the Yukawa coupling and tying that Yukawa coupling to, this has no variation in alpha, and so it's just showing you the effect of this S parameter. Okay, this is the thing that's very uncertain, but should be on the order of a couple hundred or so. And you see the change in the lithium abundance that typically brings it down for that variation in the Yukawas. And you see the effects on deuterium and helium-3. And the last one is you're just letting everything go again, and is a function with a fixed value of S and is a function of R. Now, there was a question earlier, how does this relate to the variation in alpha? That's, you know, that's the ones that Victor was talking about in the quasar absorption system. It's actually the opposite sign. So if you're doing all this where you're relating alpha to H, and so what you need is a delta H over H, which is positive, and so the delta alpha over alpha would also be positive, but of the opposite sign. Okay. Of course, doesn't mean anything, because now you need a model. That's not to say, that just means there's a little more work to do if you wanted to explain both things. Right? You would have to have a model in which the sign of the delta alpha over alpha changes with time. Of course, because this is a BBN, those things, which is redshift 10 to the 10, the quasar absorption systems are at redshift of 3. So you need something that changes by a small amount, because anyway, the variations are small. You're going from positive 10 to the minus 5 to negative 10 to the minus 5. Okay. You can make models like that, dynamical models. It's a scalar field that's oscillating in something. So it's that in itself.
Right. You can throw off a lot of reasons.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, I wrote a paper, but negative variation was this alpha. But
Okuro constraint is too strong. Okuro is 2 billion years ago, so you.
Yeah.
No, but that's okay, because now you have another. You have to.
Minimum.
Yeah, you have to fit, right? You've got 3 points.
Given a parameter space of potentials for quintessence model, you can have, you know, your alpha going in circles or whatever.
Yeah, and you can make alpha do what you want, right? I mean, that's. So. None of these things contradict each other per se. Then it's up to you whether you like the model, you don't like the model, whether you believe it or not. But this is what happens if you let everything go and do very relatively still simple things, because even this isn't complete in terms of what actually is varying and how the final abundance has come out. So, okay, I'm going to stop there. You know, variations of alpha are certainly an interesting thing. They will have an effect on BBN, and you don't need very much of a variation to get that effect on BBN. You know, is this the solution to the lithium problem? I still like something a little bit more mundane, astrophysical. But maybe it's not. Maybe this is a sign of new physics, and that's what we have to find, and whether it's decaying particles or something, like variation of constants, we don't know.
So to summarize this, variation of alpha for BBN is the change of timing, right, for various reactions without changing the number of neutrinos or without putting a lot of additional energy.
That's right.
With the same eta.
Same eta. Eta's been fixed. Right. Yeah, eta's fixed. Right,
so it's a trick for changing.
Yeah, it's a trick. And then
I think it's just the best. I probably mentioned this. The best would be just to say what, you know, with changing the different binding energy you need, and the software. Right, then everyone could
could fit into their own model.
That's right. Because that part
that's the overriding effect.
That's the overriding effect, and that's the least uncertain effect.
Right.
Right. Well, you know, where the how you go from a model to the actual change in the blue round binding energy has the huge uncertainties.
Yeah, you probably would be nice to probably set it already. So what's the relative change? It's 1%, right, in the neutron binding energy.
Six percent.
6%
or so. For
it's
that.
In neutron binding.
In neutron binding. The blue curve is delta BB over BB.
So is the proton neutron mass ratio difference big?
It is for this blue curve. You know, in the other curves, I show everything's varying. But this is just showing what are the relative contributions. So if I only vary the neutron-proton mass difference is the dashed curve here. So on this scale, well, for lithium, it's not important. But you see, neutron for helium is very important.
And that's the QMT.
Yeah,
the dashed curve, the legend actually applies to all the panels. So the blue dashed curve is the variation of the neutron-proton mass difference. So for helium, it's very important, right? Which is the way everybody started looking about the variations in the couplings, because that has a direct piece that's proportional to alpha. And so if you vary alpha, then you know that the neutron-proton mass difference is going to change, and you can get a limit right away on that variation.
Is the effect of the Yukawa coupling in terms of up-go-down-go mass quantity, is it electromagnetic? What fixes the QMT? From the model point of view, what determines
the mass difference? Well, oops.
The contribution to electromagnetics and quark.
Yeah, but no, I think he meant more specifically. Probably the other equation that had all the pieces.
Two combinations. Delta alpha and delta
eight. It's this one. Here you go. So all the pieces before we do any monkey business is here, right? Alpha, lambda, Yukawa, and Higgs-Wedel. And then we start making relationships between these things and reduce it down to one parameter.
Very good. We are done with our small meeting. And thank you, everyone. And we'll have more fun in the afternoon with the passports yourself.